This episode is sponsored by Pants. Nobody likes them, but the police still make us wear them. You're listening to The Keith Show, starring Keith. I'm Keith. I had a very high voice there. Let's try that again. You're listening to The Keith Show, starring Keith. I'm Keith. Okay, today's episode, I'm going to be flying solo to talk about my favorite movies of 2014. Going to try to do this every year. I questioned how to do this the best way, what the best way to do this was, whether or not I should do like the traditional top 10 list of, you know, ranking them in a certain order, or just what do you do? So I'm going to try something a little bit different this year. And I'm curious as to the feedback it'll get. I picked the 25 movies that I believe were the best for whatever subjective reasons that I could come up with. Because, let's face it, it is an entirely subjective thing. There's no way of saying this is one product is better than another product. It's just personal opinion, and I'm going to give the reasons that I think these are the ones that stood out for this year. Now, I'm not ranking them in any particular order. I decided to just throw them all out there alphabetically. Because, I mean, things are, which one is better than another, that kind of changes day to day. This is a little more fair, I think. So, we'll see. We'll see how this works out. Ultimately, it becomes an experiment. So, bear with me. I've written down some notes for each of these. And I go through. Now, obviously, these are not going to be the same choices as yours. But they were the choices that I thought was most appropriate. And I will, of course, point out that there's no way that I can see all of the films that came out in the past year. Some particular oversights that I wanted to see, but I didn't get a chance to, were Rosewater and Mockingjay Part 1. But I did see a lot of movies. So I try to keep up with as much of it as I can. So, I'm just going to go through them alphabetically and go through my notes. So, this is a great episode so far, isn't it? Okay. The Babadook, written and directed by Jennifer Kent. Guillermo del Toro described it as a horrifying fable, scary, elegant, and smart. I describe it as one of the best new horror films to come out in years. This little-known Australian movie deals with a mother and son plagued by the arrival of a disturbing children's book, and Mr. Babadook, the malevolent figure whose presence it heralds. There are shades of The Exorcist, The Shining, and The Devil's Backbone. And if you're a horror fan, you need to see it. Big Eyes, directed by Tim Burton from a screenplay by Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski. Big Eyes was a breath of fresh air for me due to the fact that it was a stylistic departure from the formula Tim Burton has been repeating over and over again for the past few years. By playing in a different genre and with a different style of film, he seems to have reawakened his creative spark. Something else that I think is worth mentioning about this is his use of color. There are extremely highly saturated tones, and it comes across simply gorgeously. Big Hero 6, directed by Don Hall and Chris Williams, from a screenplay by Jordan Roberts, Daniel Gerson, and Robert L. Baird. If you've been listening to this show long enough, you'll recall that several episodes back, Ryan King and I reviewed this, and we both had amazingly high praise for it. Ryan said that it instantly became one of his favorite Disney films, which, if you know anything about Ryan and his love of Disney, it's no small praise. And taking a little-known superhero team from Marvel and setting them in a world all their own, Disney created a film that can appeal to anyone. A fun, stylish action-adventure with a lot of heart. Birdman, directed by Alejandro González Iñárritu, from a screenplay by Alejandro González Iñárritu, Nicholas Giacobone, Alexander Di Nolaris, and Armando Bo. A clever script and a novel approach to the filmmaking are counterbalanced by fantastic performances. The passion and pain of the creative arts play out in hallucinatory vignettes as the main character loses more and more of himself to the expectations of the past and his hopes for the future. I think it's easy to say that this is the dawn of a career renaissance for Michael Keaton, and we will be seeing a lot of him on the screen in the next few years. The Box Trolls, directed by Graham Annabelle and Anthony Stacci, from a screenplay by Irina Brignall and Adam Pava. I love Laika. In an age where computer animation has nearly completely taken over feature films, there's an extra degree of love and heart in stop motion. Every film that Laika makes pushes the art further. It's really a good time to be a stop motion fan. Boyhood, written and directed by Richard Linklater. I'm not gonna lie, I pretty much fully expected to hate this movie. It had gotten so much hype from people based on the concept alone that I thought it was gonna be a kind of exercise in gimmick over substance and come across as kind of, you know, pretentious in the trade-off. And it easily could have, but through some kind of small miracle, Linklater managed to pull it all off. The film is shot in pieces, and it was shot over the course of 12 years, so it's a story of this boy aging from 6 to 18. In a way, for me, it felt like reading the back archives of a Slice of Life webcomic, because I figure the writing had to be done just before they started filming each individual part. What it culminates into is a story about discovering who you are, growing and changing, and embracing the magic of the ordinary moments in life. Calvary, written and directed by John Michael McDonough. The first words we hear in the movie Calvary are, "I first tasted semen when I was 7 years old." We hear that with the film's protagonist, Father James, sitting in a confessional as he hears this shocking revelation from an unseen speaker. With a wonderful sense of downplayed irony, the priest responds by saying, "That's certainly a startling opening line." The unseen speaker goes on to reveal that he was raped by a now-dead priest over a course of several years, and as a means of retribution, he intends to kill Father James in a week, the reason being that to kill a bad priest would mean nothing, but to kill an innocent priest, a good priest, would be a real statement. For the rest of the week, the priest tends to his flock, a deeply troubled group, leaving us, the audience, to wonder who the murderer is, and if the priest will indeed meet this grisly appointment. The film's sense of dread gets more and more palpable as the invisible clock ticks down. I read one review of this that described it as a sort of spiritual high noon, and I think that's pretty apt. In fact, the title is a reference to Calvary Hill, better known as Golgotha, where Christ was crucified, and the idea of knowing that you were going to a certain fate. Brendan Gleeson gives a breathtaking performance. The sort of thing that could be called career-defining. It's amazing. And I think that this movie could be equally appreciated by both the most diehard Catholics and the most devoted atheists. If I was going to give any one of these movies the official title of Best Movie of the Year, I think it would be very well be this one. It's a film that demands multiple viewings to appreciate the nuance and to appreciate the beauty of the stark Irish landscape. Captain America, The Winter Soldier, directed by Joe and Anthony Russo, from a screenplay by Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely. I'm aware that I'm biased when it comes to Marvel Studios. I mean, I'm pretty much the very definition of their target demographic. But, I mean, the fact remains they're still making amazing movies. Filled with big-scale action, humor, and heart. They're giving me everything I could possibly want from a trip to the movies. And Winter Soldier had, I think, probably the, as far as I'm concerned, the best action sequences of the year. What really made it special, though, was that it was actually still genuinely inspiring. It made you believe in the idea of a hero. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, directed by Matt Reeves, from a screenplay by Mark Bomback, Rick Jaffa, and Amanda Silver. I quite liked Rise of the Planet of the Apes. This sequel took everything that was good about that and then turned it up to 11. It's set, the plague that was set up at the end of Rise has wiped out most of humanity, and there's been war, so now humanity is in these small clusters and the world's all screwed up. And in a way, the society that Caesar has set up for his apes is almost as stable as anything else humans have. So these two forces come into, like, a collision that I think really holds true to the original, the spirit of the original franchise. So I think if you're a fan of the older films, you'll really like what they're doing with this. Edge of Tomorrow, directed by Doug Liman, from a screenplay by Christopher McQuarrie, Jez Butterworth, and John Henry Butterworth. Groundhog Day with space aliens and power armor. That would be a lazy way of describing this. But that's exactly how I'm going to do it. Tom Cruise hasn't been so likable on screen in years. And Emily Blunt is the fantasy girl of any anime fan or war gamer. She did such a great job here that I really would like to see her take on the role of Captain Marvel. The time travel in this is used so cleverly, both for action and humor. It's really inventive. Foxcatcher, directed by Bennett Miller, from a screenplay by Emax Fry and Dan Futterman. One word. Performances. This movie is all about the amazing performances. Mark Ruffalo, great as always. Steve Carell is completely unrecognizable. And I never knew that Channing Tatum could be that good. Godzilla, directed by Gareth Edwards, from a screenplay by Max Borenstein and Dave Callahan. There was a lot of contention about this movie. People seemed to either love it or hate it, with no middle ground whatsoever. I fell on the side of loving it. It delivered everything I could possibly want out of a Godzilla movie. Especially in light of the last American attempt to make one. It was big-scale action, fantastic special effects, great creature design, and the Jaws-style slow build just ratcheted up the tension towards the climax. That was something that a lot of people didn't like, but that's one of the things that just made me love it. It was so suspensefully paced. They really, it was like the exact opposite of what everyone complains about in like a Michael Bay film, where it's just like everything on screen all the time. It was methodical. And they even managed to maintain the original themes of Godzilla, in that it was an anti-nuclear proliferation movie in a kind of way. Mankind attempts to solve the situation of Godzilla and the Mudos by just basically throwing a bigger bomb at the problem, which just backfires and becomes yet a bigger problem that we have to solve, but with a little help from the King of the Monsters. Gone Girl, directed by David Fincher, from a screenplay written by Gillian Flynn. This is an intelligent and thrilling murder mystery with more twists and turns than my lower intestinal tract. I dare not say much more because not knowing what happens in it is pretty much the entire point. I do, however, want to give extra praise to the performance of Carrie Coon as Ben Affleck's sister Margot in it. I'd never seen the actress before, but she owned every scene she was in. And it wasn't by doing anything, she didn't tear up the scenery or anything like that. It was a nice, really subtle performance. It was really well done. The Grand Budapest Hotel, directed by Wes Anderson, from a screenplay by Wes Anderson and Hugo Guinness. No one can make a Wes Anderson movie but Wes Anderson. And that's just fine, because even though he's embraced a definitive style, it never comes across as self-referential, and he always finds a way to do something new with it. Grand Budapest Hotel seems to be his take on the great screwball comedies of the 1940s, a rollicking caper filled with zany and memorable characters. Guardians of the Galaxy, directed by James Gunn, from a screenplay by James Gunn and Nicole Perlman. I went to see this 3 times in the first week that it was out. That should tell you something right there. It is without doubt the most fun I had at the movies this year. The beauty of what Marvel is doing now is that they've completely thrown the normal movie studio rules out the window. They're telling a continuous story over the course of dozens of films, with even more characters, taking big risks, and not playing it safe. We have a screen universe where Howard the Duck exists with Captain America, and it seems perfectly consistent. And I think what comes across by their method is that they're not underestimating the intelligence of their audience by assuming we're not going to be able to follow along. They're telling their story their way, and it's that faith on their part is being returned handsomely to them at the box office, so it's clear that it works. It's my favorite movie of the year. The Imitation Game, directed by Morten Tildum, from a screenplay by Graham Moore. I don't think it's overstating the case to say that Alan Turing was amongst those who had the greatest impact on the 20th century. As the father of computer science, his machines defined the shape of the century's second half. As the father of the nascent field of artificial intelligence, his work could very well redefine the shape of the next century. As if that weren't enough, his work in cracking the Nazi Enigma machine helped to essentially save the future of the human race. He was repaid for these contributions to the world by being criminalized. Criminalized because he happened to be gay, and forced into a program of chemical castration which impeded his ability to use that remarkable brain. A loss which ultimately led to him taking his own life. Benedict Cumberbatch, plays Turing as a man who can barely relate to the human race, but still never loses his essential humanity. As a species, we always seem to harm those we don't understand. And perhaps Alan Turing's inability to understand the human race says far more about us than it did him. Interstellar, directed by Christopher Nolan from a screenplay by Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan. This is another movie that people seem to either love or hate. A lot of people find Nolan to be overly expositional or something. Pretentious? Hard to follow? I'm not really sure. I've never really identified what the specific complaint is. And I've never, maybe because I don't see it myself, so I've always enjoyed his films and I've never had a problem with them. Interstellar brings us an amazing hard science fiction film with real humanity behind it. The visuals are breathtaking. Some of the most stunning you'll ever see on the big screen. The spherical wormhole with realistic gravitational lensing effects, a watery world under the brutal tidal forces of a black hole, a planet of frozen clouds. I didn't see this on IMAX, but I bet it was mind-blowing. Plus, the robot was awesome. In Your Eyes, directed by Bryn Hill, from a screenplay by Joss Whedon. It's the best romance of the year, and the two main characters only share about a minute of screen time at the very end. A young man and woman on opposite sides of the country, each a lost soul in their own right, share a psychic connection which enables them to see through one another's eyes, feel what each other feels, and hear each other when they speak out. They embark on an unusual friendship, which grows into a love built on a connection that's much deeper than their psychic bond. Jodorowsky's Dune. Directed by Frank Pavich. You can probably guess that this was my favorite documentary. It's the only one on this list, after all. The film details the failed attempt by Alejandro Jodorowsky to adapt Frank Herbert's Dune. The man assembled an all-star team to back him up, and they put together a massive pitch bible, complete with art from some of the industry's best. We're talking H.R. Giger, Chris Floss, and Mobius. Dan O'Bannon was to do the special effects. Pink Floyd and Magma were attached to do the music. Orson Welles, Salvador Dali, Gloria Swanson, David Carradine, and Mick Jagger were attached to star. The film itself sounds like it was going to be batshit insane. And the documentary shows that that's because Jodorowsky himself is that same brand of insane. In the end, you aren't surprised that the movie didn't get made. He wanted it to be like between 12 and 20 hours long, with a budget that could have purchased a small country. But it's just amazing to think about this thing that was so developed and never followed through on. The Lego Movie, directed by Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, from a screenplay by Phil Lord, Christopher Miller, Dan Hageman, and Kevin Hageman. Who knew, right? A movie that no one expected to happen, with what I'm sure probably required a ridiculous amount of licensing agreements, and the most bizarre kind of studio faith that I could think of. I'd have loved to have sat in on the pitch meeting for this. It's ridiculously silly, gloriously funny, and yet incredibly touching in ways that I didn't expect. As the song says, everything is awesome. Muppets Most Wanted, directed by James Bobin, from a screenplay by James Bobin and Nicholas Stoller. It's the Muppets. What more do I really need to say? Really, that's all I got for it. It's the Muppets, man. It's awesome. Snowpiercer, directed by Junho Bong, from a screenplay by Junho Bong and Kelly Masterson. In the future, an attempt to solve global warming backfires and sinks the planet into a new ice age. The remaining few humans alive all live on a train which circumnavigates the globe once per year. The train is socially stratified, with the upper classes living towards the front and the lower classes at the rear. So, the backstory doesn't quite make as much sense as you would like. But that's completely unimportant, because when the movie gets going, you will be on the edge of your seat. As the passengers in the rear of the train begin a revolution that takes them towards the front, car by car, what unfolds is an amazingly stylish, frenetic ballet of beautifully hyper-stylized violence and dark twists. You will not be able to look away. Plus, you know, in my book, any movie that has John Hurt, bonus points. The Theory of Everything, directed by James Marsh, from a screenplay by Anthony McCartan. The previews build this as either a bio or a love story, and neither is quite true. Instead, what we get is a portrait of a relationship. We shouldn't expect a storybook ending here, as anyone who knows about Stephen Hawking's life knows that even though he has surpassed every expectation of his condition, he's still getting worse to this day. And the relationship that is portrayed in the film, the marriage of Stephen and Jane Hawking, did actually end in divorce. That said, even though all this happens on screen, the film doesn't end without hope. It shows a more nuanced relationship. It shows how a relationship can survive past divorce based on friendship, shared history, and respect. And it makes you realize that just because the romantic part of a love affair ends and you're no longer with somebody, it doesn't mean you still don't love them. Maybe that's the takeaway, that even though in the darkest time, there's still a good thing that comes out of it. Whiplash, written and directed by Damien Chazelle. It would be hard to endorse the message of this film, and I'm not really sure if the film tries to have a message. It's a story of a young drummer at a music conservatory under the tutelage of an abusive, overbearing, perfectionist professor, played with a kind of malevolent glee by J.K. Simmons. I don't think it's saying anything so much as examining the extreme personalities of the sort of people who would sacrifice so much for their passion. Genius and madness, obsession and perfection, these are all counterbalancing forces on the head of a pin. Finally, X-Men Days of Future Past, directed by Bryan Singer, from a screenplay by Simon Kinberg, Jane Goldman, and Matthew Vaughn. Combining the casts of the original X-Men film trilogy with the first class cast was an unenviable task, but they pulled it off into a cohesive whole by referencing one of the greatest X-Men stories of all time, bringing the Sentinels, a major element from the comics that hadn't yet seen the big screen. In a way, this movie could have easily functioned as the final X-Men film And that would have been okay because the end of the movie serves as a fine coda for the entire franchise. That we're getting more is just icing on the cake, as far as I'm concerned. So there they are, the 25 films that were the best for me in 2014. I highly recommend that you watch all of them. Most of all, I want to encourage discussion. If you're on the Facebook page, I want to hear what you thought were the best films of 2014. Yeah, let me know.
This has been The Keith Show, starring Keith. Please follow us on Twitter at KeithShowPod or like us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you. Our theme music is 8-Bit Dungeon Boss by Kevin MacLeod, provided via Creative Commons license. The Keith Show is a proud member of the Deliberate Noise Network. For this and other great shows, visit DeliberateNoise.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.